Tony, in the literature, you sent us the pages of running down a bit of a rundown of your system. You do mention soil depth now, and then you do mention that there's less grass pull. So what was the savings on the whiting's place when it comes to grass depth and just what I just said? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good point, and we've got to be careful. We've got to qualify this a little bit. The whitings have a sandy loam or a sand. It varies a little bit over the farm. Their biggest driver, which is why they invited us on the farm, was that in the middle of winter, the cows were pulling the grass out by the roots, and they'd seen a presentation that we gave where we showed extra root depth on the control versus a treated area with compost and compost teas. And Andrew said, right, you need to come out to my farm. That is probably the single biggest thing that is impacting on my profitability, because he was spending, I think the year before we started with this, he spent $27,000 on just sod seeding three quarters of his farm. So each autumn he would have no grass left in places, and I mean literally no grass. And I've sent through some photos to, I think, Hugo, showing the next door neighbour's place, which is farmed the way that Andrew used to farm. And they're still doing it. They still have to sod seed every year, despite the fact we had a wet summer and a good autumn. So there shouldn't have been any pasture losses over the dry time. But they still have the sod seed, and the dominant species in there was sorrel, which is not very productive. Whereas over the fence, Andrew, the only thing he had done to his paddocks different to the other side was, well, there's several things. One was cut out the chemical fertilisers, put on compost at 3 tonnes at a hectare, and turn to a liquid nitrogen. He hasn't actually put any P or K out there for 3 years. He's monitoring that with his soil test to make sure that he doesn't undermine it. But he's putting the P and K out in the compost that went on. So, and with the liquid nitrogen spray, he's been able to then start getting mycorrhizal fungi come back into the soil. So he's actually accessing P and K that was normally not available to him. And the difference is significant. The difference was that he had feed that was in places in that paddock knee-high, and this is the Thursday before Easter. Other places near the fence line, it was not quite that high, but it was probably halfway up the shin. And the paddock next door, the neighbours, which is now his control, you couldn't feed cows in it. You would have to supplement the cows if you put them in that paddock. There was not enough feed in the paddock to feed the cows. So quite dramatic on lighter soils. So Andrew spent $7,000 the next year after spending $27,000 the previous year before he started with us on some pasture renovation. So he has got an ongoing pasture renovation program, and we do encourage that because some of the better cultivars will give you obviously better production. So if we can still change the fertiliser program, but most of the rest of the farm management can still stay the same. So you still want to drain your paddocks, you still want to keep looking at your different cultivars for different reasons, and just incorporate what we're doing into a progressive farming system. Yeah. On a heavier soil,
Tony,
different kettle fish.
Sorry, keep going. Sorry, sir.
Yeah. On a heavy soil, different kettle fish, obviously. They don't have the same grass pulling problems. A bit tougher to get the roots down, but the sand actually illustrates changes a lot quicker. So I suppose we've been able to show changes in a very short space of time on the whitings farm, but we're doing it on other farms with other soil types. It just might be a little bit slower in showing changes. Yep.
Thanks for that explanation, Tony. When you mention root depth, to me that also indicates that the roots going down deeper, they access more minerals because the minerals quite often are leached down deeper.
Yep.
Has there been any evidence on more nutritious grass, like is there better health for the animals? Is there any sort of evidence that the grass is of a higher quality that's been produced on the Whiting's property?
Yes, well, 2 years ago, the percentage of empty cows was 25% in the first 23 weeks. I think that's how it's managed through their farm consultant that they use for their whole farm. This last year, it was 7%. Now, we don't know, obviously we're looking at trends, so we don't know whether that's just because we've had a good season and blah, 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 but we're watching that very closely because that's a really good indicator of animal health. We picked some clover there a couple of weeks ago, and it tasted like, we ate it, and it tasted like lettuce. It didn't have a bit of taste to it. So this was grass and clover that was between halfway up your knee, halfway up your shin and knee high, so it was ready to be grazed in the next few days, which it probably has now. And it hadn't had any nitrogen applied to it at all. The 3 tonne of compost has only been out a week or 10 days, and that was the first round of nitrogen. There is enough, at 3 tonnes a hectare, there is a bit of nitrogen available for the first round, and Andrew cut that out from after the response that he got last year from the first round of the compost going on. So the fact that it's a lot sweeter indicates to us that it's probably more balanced. On a Brix reading, we are getting higher Brix readings. I think initially when we started between ones and twos, which is fairly typical in a conventional system. The other day we tested it, it was a cloudy day, and we were up around the fives and sixes on a cloudy day. So we're reasonably happy with that.
Tony, I've got interrupted. That is actually a phenomenal increase in the Brix, because that... if farmers aren't familiar with Brix, Brix is it's a number of different explanations, whether it's sugar, whether it's actually mineral contents, whether it's solids in the liquid. So irrespective of the explanation what Brix measures, that moving it from 1 to 2 to 5 to 6 is like more than doubling the solids in the liquid off the grass. How would you sort of see that, Tony?
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. And Arden Anderson talks about that. He says if you double your Brix, he says you actually double the food that you've got to work with. And then he says, and I'll repeat myself, he actually made a point. So double your Brix, you double your mineral density. And your mineral density is what the cows are chasing, of course. So, if we're running ones and twos, which is what most of the conventional farmers do at this time of the year, obviously they get higher in the spring when you get more fibre in your grass. But to be running at five or six, you know, they've gone from somewhere between double to triple the feed value in that feed. So absolutely, it is a good result. For this time of the year, it's a very good result. So ideally we want to get it higher, and I know in the spring it'll definitely be higher. There's still room to move. There's still room to improve, yeah. Probably the biggest plus probably the thing that I measure as much as anything is I really look forward to getting more mycorrhizal fungi into a soil system. I really think that that's a really good indicator of soil health. If we can get mycorrhizal fungi colonising.
Tony, sorry to interrupt you, but can you sort of explain a little bit about the value of mycorrhizal fungi or what it is? Because it's something that quite often is not taught in agricultural schools and colleges and universities. So, and maybe even explain its value and the interlink between atmospheric gases and mycorrhizal fungi. Sorry to interrupt you, but is that a fair thing to ask you now?
Absolutely. I think we've got to explain mycorrhizal fungi because it's so important in the ability of the plant to take up nutrients. Basically, a plant is green and photosynthesizes and produces sugars during the day. A percentage of those sugars are dumped into the root zone overnight, and those sugars are used by the flora and fauna in the root zone to as a carbon source, as an energy source. Now, mycorrhizal fungi, although it's a type of plant, it's not green, and it grows underground, and it can't photosynthesize and produce its own sugars, but it can solubilize nutrients, and it grows in strands in hyphae. And what happens is when the plant is lacking a particular element, it'll send down enzymes or different types of sugars indicating it needs, say, phosphorus, and basically it's telling the fungi, among other things, I want phosphorus. So the fungi says, well, if I want to look after this plant I have to keep feeding it what it needs, and it feeds what I need. So what it does is it'll solubilize phosphorus, as an example, and pipe it back to the root for the root to take it up in a form that it can. So it's what's called a symbiotic relationship. So you've got the plant supplying sugars, and then you've got the fungi supplying nutrients. And unfortunately, in conventional farming systems, we've done probably 150 soil food web tests over 12, 13 years, and every single one will come back zero. And it's really only the last 3 years when we've started to be able to up the ante in our compost rates and move away from the ureas and the water-soluble fertilisers that we're starting to see mycorrhizal fungi move back in. So what we're actually doing, we're actually giving the plant the opportunity to access a lot of that nutrient that's tied up. And that's a really good, one indicator of soil health, because we're obviously, if we've got that coming back into the soil profile, there's going to be a lot of other organisms that will move back in as well, because mycorrhizal fungi is part of the fungal biomass that we need in the soil. So it's not the only indicator, but it's a good indicator. There are a lot of other nutrient cycling organisms in the soil, like protozoa eating bacteria, and they have different ratios of nutrients in their system. And if they are at different ratios, they excrete out the nutrients that they don't need because they've got a different concentration of that particular nutrient. That's all plant available, and that's nutrient cycling. And we need to encourage it as much as we can rather than nuke it and compromise it. So that's mycorrhizal fungi in a nutshell. I mean, there are a lot of other things happening at the same time, but that's one indicator we like to work with.
So the plant is actually, like Dr. Christine Jones talks about, carbon dioxide being transferred into the soil through the exudates, as you explained that, as the sugars.
Yep.
So there is a... Can you sort of see there is a connection between atmospheric gases and, the mycorrhizal fungi, or how would you sort of see that?
Absolutely. Those sugars are all carbohydrates, which are types of carbons being put back in the soil. So that's right, the carbon dioxide is part of what we're taking out of the air, and the exudates and sugars, et cetera, is the form that we put the carbon back into the soil. So obviously some of that carbon, it will be tied up in all sorts of forms. It's tied up in biology, it's tied up in root growth, it's tied up in organic matter, it gets tied up in different ways. Some of it's more stable than others, and if ever there's a carbon tax come in and they can understand how to measure the carbon in the soil, obviously, if we can increase the amount of the ability of the plant to retain that carbon into the soil, that's a really plus. That's a big plus. So if we can increase root depth, what we're doing is we're actually increasing the ability to move carbon into the soil, because we're working on a larger area. So it's three-dimensional, the soil, and we've got to understand that it's an enormous bank that we've got to, one, put carbon in the soil, and two, access nutrients. And the two are tied up. There's no question you can't do one without the other, I believe.
Yeah, exactly. So I think most farmers would, I think all farmers would realise, or not realise, know that organic carbon or humus or organic matter is carbon. And so what you're saying is that the mycorrhizae is actually... taking advantage of that or generating that carbon. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's doing several things. One is it's helping to increase your root depth and biomass. So mycorrhizal fungi is only one form of fungi in the soil. There's lots of other forms of fungi in the soil, and collectively they'll help open up the soil profile and allow the plant to send its roots down further. So as much as I like singling out mycorrhizal for its role as a nutrient cycling, but it's only one of many contributors towards holding carbon in the soil. So the ability to open up the soil that fungi does then allows extra roots to grow, so that's another form of carbon. It's an organic carbon form in roots. You've got the biomass of the fungi itself, which has got carbon tied up in it. You've got the ability to sink that carbon further into the soil, so that helps keep it stable and in that soil environment. And your carbon is part of the energy that feeds your biology. So you can stimulate extra nutrient cycling from the fact that you're putting more carbon into the soil. So there's a lot of chain reactions, and I don't think anyone really fully understands it. I don't think we have to fully understand it all either. But certainly, the fact that you're building organic matter in your soil in different forms is a plus. And obviously, some of those are much more stable than others, and some of those will be one day. Hopefully, the farmers will be paid for. I'm not sure how much of it we can be paid for. We don't want to be paid for anything that's not stable. Otherwise, we might have to pay it back the next year if it's not there. So we just need to understand what portions we want to be paid for storing and what portions we want to ignore from a fluctuation point of view with seasonal variations. And I think that's the bit that that people are a bit confused about. How do you measure it properly at this stage?
Tony, I just want to go through this again. You had 7 farmers that were using your compost, is that right?
On farm.
The year before?
Yep.
And now it's moved to 15.
Yes.
Is that right? You've got 15 farmers are doing it. And And you've, correct me if I'm wrong, because what I want to move to is you've got 40 farmers who are going to take it on or interested in taking it on in the next
Pretty
year,
much,
is that right?
Yeah, we've got about 40 farmers committed for next year. We started working with them already. So what they're doing is they've bought a bit of our compost to do some trial work to get some confidence in the system, or they've started using some fish and compost teas so that the program doesn't have to start until they've made their own compost. The program can start now, and they can use our compost in the first year if they wish and start the ball rolling, and then next spring they're stockpiling their waste now and et cetera, and then by next spring they'll start making their own compost. There's no reason why they can't start today, for instance. They can start moving away from using a granular urea to a liquid nitrogen. That can start now. So a lot of these farmers are starting to commit to a program, even though they haven't actually made their own compost on farm yet.